You're listening to The Lyric Feature on RTE Lyric FM.
On this week's Lyric Feature, the second episode of our series Feather and Flock, in which ecologist Anya Murray and musician Brian McLean explore the worlds of native Irish birds. In this programme, they're looking at one of the great dissemblers of the woodlands, the jay.
Welcome to episode 2 of Feather and Flock, a series about six exceptional Irish birds. My name is Brian McGlynn, and together with my friend and fellow bird enthusiast Anya Murray, we're going to be exploring the world of jays, their behaviour, intelligence, and the woodland habitats where they live. We'll also be delving into some of the folklore that surrounds these colourful birds, with French and Catalan folktales that I've rewritten and set into song with songwriter Rita Perry. And we'll hear traditional Occitan music related to jays from nickel harpa player Aina Tullier. Many people nowadays are not familiar with jays, even though these birds are one of the most striking birds breeding in Ireland, as well as being one of the noisiest and cleverest birds around. Perhaps because jays are so good at not being seen, rarely venturing far from cover, most of us aren't familiar with how they look.
Jays are a stunning woodland bird with exceptional cognitive abilities. But before we find out more about how they came to be so smart, I want to talk a little bit about evolution and adaptation. Birds are everywhere, calling out over ocean waves, flying high above mountain passes, sheltering in the softness of an old bog, or flitting through the canopy of an old oak woodland. And while some species are generalists, adapted for a range of habitat types, most species have evolved to live well in a very particular set of parameters, a quite specific habitat niche. For this, the colours and patterns of their feathers will have evolved to suit. Their bill is perfectly adapted to feed on a particular type of food, perhaps a delicate curve to best catch flying insects with, or stout and strong to crush seeds. Each species' wings are adapted to suit too, perhaps for agile flight through the clutter of woodland branches, or a life of diving in cold lake water to feed on tiny snails. These multitude of adaptations are what make each species so distinct, so different to each other in their appearance and life strategy. In this episode of Feather and Flock, Brian and I will be exploring how jays have adapted to thrive as a key species in the deciduous woodlands where they live. Months ago, I went to a talk by ornithologist Sean Ronayne, creator of Irish Wildlife Sounds. He spoke about his mission to record the song of every regularly occurring bird species in Ireland, and told the audience some of what he's discovered about bird mimics too. Lots of different birds mimic the sounds that others make, but it turns out that jays are especially good mimics. I wanted to know more. So Sean agreed to meet Brian and I in an old deciduous woodland in County Leash, in the hope we could listen to jays calling out from the canopy and have Sean talk us through the impressive vocal abilities and some of their other amazing behaviours.
Jay often surprises people when you tell them it's a corvid because of the fact that they're so brightly coloured. Like when you think of crows, you think of a black plain looking bird, but jays are, how would you describe it? It's like a salmon pink, and then when they fly they've got this big bright white rump, and then when you, if you see them up close enough, you can see there's a patch of blue, like vivid blue and black feathering as well, which is it's almost exotic looking. Well, I can hear them.
When you walk into a woods like this, are you listening first or looking first?
Listening. So when, like, I use my ear a lot for bird surveys, especially for transects, for the smaller species passerines, I use my ear almost entirely. Obviously, I'm looking as well. But, you know, especially in the summer when there's a lot of cover, birds are hidden and they're singing from the cover. So if you don't know the songs and the calls on those surveys, you can't really do the surveys. So my ear is important as an ornithologist, as a surveyor. My father would bring me out into the pram and he would mimic the calls of different birds and ask me what they were. So he started to teach me bird sounds when I was like two, whatever. So I started young.
It's like your second language. It's like they say when you bring up a child bilingual. You were brought up bilingual in bird and English.
And a woodland like this in autumn, I think the most characteristic sound would be the screeching of a jay.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, totally. Yeah. Jay is an iconic bird of deciduous woodlands, and they're very secretive, so they're very difficult to see. And in the autumn, it's actually a lot easier to track them down because of the fact that there are no leaves or there are less leaves in the trees. So it's a great time to see them.
I have jays in the garden. Have the jays got Cork accents?
They could do, you know. It's entirely possible, but they've not shown it to me yet. did you hear about the starling?
No.
The starling with the Cork accent. There was a starling that lived on my roof in near Mallow, and it was mimicking. And I left my recorder out so the prowler was pointed at the roof so it would capture the starling's song. And then one day when I was going through it, I heard a voice and it said, "Come here." And I thought it was me. And then when I listened more closely or looked more carefully, I realised that this word, "come here," appeared in the very same place, in the same verse, same location every time. And then I realised it was a starling. And I actually heard and saw it do it afterwards. It was weird.
So the starling was mimicking you saying "come here" in your Cork accent?
In a Cork accent, yeah.
And the sound that I know of jays is just this screeching, kind of raucous, like a magpie.
Yeah.
But they make a whole range of different sounds.
Yeah.
And they mimics as well, right?
Yeah. That's the thing about corvids. They're very underappreciated in terms of their vocal abilities, jays included, and they can actually sing. So they have proper, legitimate song. And it's very complex. And they make some really strange sounds, like almost sounds that you'd hear in a video game. But then there's the mimicry, so they're really good mimics. And the thing about jays is they typically, like, they mimic lots of things, but mostly they mimic predators. For example, if there's a buzzard nearby and the jay sees the buzzard, it will start mimicking the sound of a buzzard. So almost as if it's warning conspecific, so others of its own kind, that there's a buzzard coming.
But the others of its kind know that it's a jay mimicking a buzzard and not a buzzard.
Yeah, so like they'll be able to tell that, but it's actually a bit of a pain when you're surveying because you have to be extra careful with that if you're in a woodland. Let's say you're monitoring whatever birds are occurring in the woodland. If you hear a buzzard calling in a deciduous woodland, you really have to double check and make sure that it isn't a jay because it sounds really accurate. Usually they'll give that typical screechy, raucous call first, and then they'll do some mimicry of a buzzard.
And who else do they mimic?
Well, they mimic dogs, apparently. So one day, I was really stressed after a long day at work, and so I brought my dog Toby out for a walk in the local woods, and
I left him off the lead and he was trotting ahead of me. And I heard a dog bark in the distance. So I went to catch up with Toby to put him on the lead so that there wasn't a disagreement between the dogs. And as I was putting him on the lead, I realised the barking was coming from above my head. And when I looked up, there was a jay bouncing aggressively, barking down at Toby. if I didn't record that, I know nobody would believe me. But I managed to record it with my phone, luckily.
And it sounded just like a dog barking.
Inseparable to the human ear. Yeah, it was amazing.
So we know that jays make this screeching kind of sound, like a magpie.
Yeah.
And we know that they can mimic dogs and cats. What other sounds can they make?
Oh, all kinds of things. I wrote down every example from Xenocanto, and there were things like different species of owls. There were different eagles in there, I think. Other corvids, various songbirds, golden oriole.
And they do beautiful singing as well, to woo a mate in spring or something. Yeah,
they do.
What does that sound like?
It sounds really surprisingly melodic. When you consider the fact that a jay is a member of the corvid family, it's a crow. Crows aren't really renowned for intricate melodic song.
Not at all.
But they should be, because they all do it. Well, not all of them, but a lot of them do. Even Hooded Crow has a lovely melodic song that many people don't know about. And the thing about it is it's very quiet and they're very secretive. They don't really let you get close to them, so you don't really experience it that often. But with the techniques that I've been using, leaving out recorders for long periods of time, I have picked up Hooded Crow's song a number of times. It's so bizarre to hear them like that.
Feathers are a bird's best friend. They assist with flying, they keep heat in and cold out. They protect the bird by providing camouflage so they can blend in with their environment. Feathers also provide aesthetic beauty with distinctive colours and patterns that are part of what helps each bird attract and maintain a mate. But feathers also require a lot of care. Each species has its differences. Some need to keep their feathers especially oiled and waterproofed. Others have particular approaches to bathing. Some birds, especially jays and other members of the crow family, sometimes flop themselves down on an anthill and allow the ants to crawl all over their feathers. The ants produce formic acid, which helps destroy any little lice that might be hiding out among the feathers. Sean has seen jays do some strange things to care for their feathers.
I've seen some really crazy behaviour with corvids. Like, once I saw a cigarette butt on the ground, and someone had just thrown it out, but they hadn't stamped it out properly, so there was smoke coming from it. And there was a hooded crow picking it up by the butt and flicking it down. So it was almost as if it was kind of trying to bring the cigarette back to life to get more smoke coming out of it. And when it did that, it was putting its wings over it. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. I need to write this up. And it's known and documented behaviour. They do this with cigarette butts to actually get the kind of toxic smoke to come up and delouse themselves. They put their wings over it then. They're incredibly intelligent.
That's wild.
It's wild.
That's absolutely wild.
But rooks will also do that. It's much easier to see them doing that over chimneys in the winter. So look at a smoky chimney and you'll often see rooks or hooded crows with their wings spread over the smoke, and they're essentially deparasitizing themselves.
Wow.
Have you seen the video of hooded crow playing on a snowy roof? I think it picks up a frisbee, it jumps into the frisbee and shoots down the roof like on a slide, picks it up and goes again. So they're clearly capable of having fun and playing games as well, you know?
Incredible. Yeah.
There's just so much more going on in birds' lives, and I think we really underestimate them.
We've kind of put it beyond the possibility that they would have lives as complicated as us,
yeah,
or needs to communicate,
yeah,
anything like as complicated
totally
as us.
Do you know what that's an example of? And it's only a word I learned recently. Anthropocentrism. Have you heard of that?
I have, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I suppose it's a fairly relevant word in terms of, yeah, what's going on with the environment and that.
We see everything from a human perspective.
Yeah.
We think our plants are so much more than everything else.
We're the center of the world, and everything else is an accessory to our needs, isn't it?
Yeah.
Jays are a wide-ranging species, living in woodlands from Western Europe right across to the eastern seaboard of Asia, down into India, Southeast Asia and parts of North Africa. In Ireland, we have an endemic subspecies of genetically unique Irish jays. They're more reclusive than their continental cousins, and often you'll just catch a glimpse of them as they fly away with a quick flash of blue and a raspy screech. This reclusive nature, combined with their well-camouflaged plumage, means it's not surprising, then, that jays are more or less completely absent from Irish folklore and music. I was delighted to find out that they're much more prominent in Western European folk music and stories, particularly in France and Spain and the region around the Pyrenees Mountains. Aina Tullier is a traditional musician, specializing in the Occitan music of southern France. Aina has quite a few songs about birds, including a few about jays, so she dropped by for a visit one day to play me some of these tunes on the otherworldly sounding nickel harpa.
My name is Aina Tullier. I'm from France. I'm living not far from Toulouse, southwest part of France, and I studied trad Occitan music, and actually I play on a Swedish fiddle called the nickel harpa, but I can also sing a bit and play a bit of fiddle and also the bagpipe, and yeah, I play mostly for dancing, traditional dancing in France. The two songs are from south of France, southwest of France, and actually there are songs which are danceable. We can dance that in a bal traditionnel. Dessus la nostra triglia, on the wire, there are birds coming. There are blackbird, we have thrush, woodpecker, and jay. So they're just singing together on that wire and having fun.
We tend to think of humans as being the smartest animals and only give credit to other primates for coming anywhere close in terms of intelligence. But scientists are beginning to understand that several members of the crow family, known as corvids, have impressive brain power too. To find out about some of this latest research, I spoke with a psychologist who has been pioneering research on the cognitive abilities of jays and their corvid cousins. Nicola Clayton is Professor of Comparative Cognition at the University of Cambridge. Her work combines psychology and zoology, and she has spent decades finding out about how birds think.
I have what we call the Corvid Palace at Manningley, part of the University of Cambridge, where I study corvid cognition, how members of the crow family, including jays, think. And I currently have 30 birds.
And what do we know about how clever jays are?
Well, I've been studying jays for decades now. And it really all started when I was a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Oxford. And I was working with jays and jackdaws and magpies, as well as with marsh tits and great tits and blue tits and coal tits. And I noticed that there seemed to be something very special about the corvids, the jays, magpies and jackdaws. So when I say corvids, I mean members of the crow family, because they really interact with people. They look you in the eye and they seem to be really savvy and attentive. And that's really what piqued my interest. And when I was a professor at the University of California in Davis, I was studying scrub jays, which are a relative of the Eurasian jay, but one that you find in California and other parts of the Americas. And I noticed that these birds would hide food very quickly when others were around. But then rather than leaving them for really long periods of time, which is the typical caching behaviour, they were coming back and recovering their stashes of food just a few minutes later once the others had left the scene. And then they were re-hiding them in new places. And of course, that got me thinking because the other birds had left. So by definition, the other birds would know the new locations of the caches. They'd think they were in the original spot. But of course, the savvy scrub jays had moved them to new places. And so as a scientist, you know, an observation is intriguing, but it doesn't prove anything. So we developed some experiments in the lab, and we found that if other birds were watching when they were hiding the food, then once the other birds had left the scene, they moved them to new hiding places. If they were caching in private, or in front of their mate with whom they pair for life and share the caches, they didn't bother. They just left the caches where they were. It was only if they'd been watched by potential thieves that they moved the caches to new places. This is both a form of thinking about the future, thinking ahead if you like, because the only point of moving them to new places is in order to get them back yourself at some point in the future. But it's also evidence of what we call theory of mind, a complex kind of social cognition that takes into account what you think others will be thinking, what you think others will be doing. And the inference, we called it, it takes a thief to know a thief, is that these birds are predicting by analogy with their own behaviour. I've been a thief in the past. If I was watching and saw somebody else catching tasty things I fancy, once they've left the scene, I'll go and steal them. And so they're using that kind of inference process to predict by analogy what they think another bird might be thinking and what that other bird might do in the future. So it's complicated cognition because it involves both thinking about other times, juxtaposing the here and now with the past and the future, but also other minds, anticipating what you think someone else might do, given what they know and what they don't know, and what they might do in the future, right? It's the interaction of times and minds, and that's why we think it's so complex. There is quiet as a mouse, and they choose to cache in places that don't make much noise, as opposed to gravel that does make noise. And yet, if they are being watched, or if they're in private, they don't. They cache in noisier places. Now, if they're being watched anyway, presumably it doesn't matter whether you're quiet or noisy, because if another individual can see, being secretive about sound doesn't help. So we think that the whole thing is that it's not just being secretive using vision. They're using this whole suite of tactics, trying to understand other minds and other times, but also using sound as well as vision, when to conceal them because others are watching and listening, and when to use it as a potential tool in order to check out if somebody else is stealing. Now, you might ask, why do we think they have these complex tactics? And we think it's because in the case of jays and other corvids that hide food, individuals both hide their own food, so they play the role of cacher, but they also steal other birds' caches.
And they must have an impressive spatial memory to know where all that food is hidden. I mean, I've heard that mice leave markers to help prompt them where to find their food hidden away. Do jays do the same thing?
Obviously, you don't want to be too obvious about it, because if you hide things and put a stone on top, then anybody else could come and go, oh, there's a stone on top of that bit of soil, must be a cache under there. So you have to play a quite a clever tactic, don't you, between making sure that it's really well concealed so others aren't going to steal it, but at the same time, remember it. And what we know is that corvids have fantastic memories. I mean, jays typically cache somewhere around the region 11,000 to 12,000 acorns in a year, and, you know, have long-lasting accurate memories of where most of them are hidden. So they really do have very long-lasting memories.
It could be argued that they're cleverer than us. I mean, in terms of memory, we all forget a pile of things. But the idea that jays and their corvid cousins are the most clever bird, can you tell me more about that?
I think, you know, 25 years ago, people would have said cognition is the province of the primates, it's monkeys and great apes, because they're our closest cousins. And at the same time, people thought that birds were creatures of instinct with little ability to learn, never mind think or have these complex thoughts about other minds and other times and strategizing about how to protect their caches. And I think two things happened. So I think in terms of research, we started to discover that these birds are extremely intelligent and seem to be on a par with the great apes when it comes to comparable tests. Indeed, my husband, Dr. Nathan Emery, and I have referred to them as feathered apes, because these corvids, such as jays, ravens and rooks, are so incredibly intelligent. And it's converging evidence. You could say, well, maybe there's something that's very special about food caching, and they seem very intelligent when it's food caching, but with everything else, they're rubbish. Well, we know that's not the case either. For example, in the wild, most corvids don't use tools, but in our lab, the jays and the rooks will happily mate, so manufacture and use tools if there's a problem that requires a tool. They don't do it in the wild because the kind of foods they eat don't require a tool. If you only ever saw me eat apples and potato crisps, I wouldn't be using a knife and fork for that either. With crisps in particular, it would be a really silly thing to do. So, you know, in terms of their diet in the wild, they don't need tools, you just need a beak. But if you give them a problem, for example, there's one thing called the Aesop's Fable water task, where you float a worm on top of the water and the water level is too low so they can't reach it. It's based on the original The Crow and the Pitcher, where in the fable the crow is thirsty and uses stones to raise the water level. Well, in our experiments, we wouldn't dream of being as cruel to make them thirsty. But we might sort of tempt them with a tasty worm, their favourite food, and we find that they will then readily put stones into the tube, raising the water level to get the worm. They don't do it if it's sand or air in the tube, so they seem to understand it's only water. And if you give them a choice of things that float and things that sink, they only put the ones that sink in. TAF's children don't pass till they're 8, for example. They'll also take pieces of straight wire and bend it into a hook to retrieve a bucket of food out of meat grates. So there's all these converging evidences that they seem to be really smart. The second thing is we now know a bit more about their brains, and that it was assumed that the areas of the brain were all areas that were involved with very simple learning processes and instinctive behaviours. But we now know that birds do have a cortex, and it's massively enlarged in the corvids. These are not just specialised things, but it's actually general thinking abilities. And we now know that that's consistent with what we know about how both mammalian and avian minds are made up of.
Summertime, the leafy layers of woodland canopy trees are full of juicy caterpillars, so this is what jays feed their chicks on. In autumn, when acorns and hazelnuts are ripening, parents continue to feed their offspring, even after they've fledged, helping them along and teaching them all the things they need to know to make their way independently in the world. The relationship between jays and the woodlands where they live is something very special. Jays have a starring role in helping some trees reproduce. We could call jays the original rewilders. To understand this relationship better, I met with ecologist Killian Roden in the gorgeous Garryland Wood in County Galway.
Overhead, the overstory is oak trees, and then underneath we've got a lovely scattering of hazel, elm, hawthorn. What else can we see?
There's a bit of ash there. You can see it. You've got the large oaks going up maybe 30 metres above our head.
And in autumn the birds are out eating a lot of these berries. What kind of birds would we find here in autumn?
Well, you'd be thinking of thrushes, blackbirds. I mean, the jay, obviously, but he's probably spending more of his time up high, up in the upper canopy. They are here. And they're also rather wonderfully, they're spreading at the moment. Because when I first came to the west of Ireland, maybe 40 years ago, jays were not a common sight at all. You know, given their capacity to take seeds with them, I wouldn't be too surprised, but they're actually moving seeds as well. Jays are important not because they bury acorns inside the oak forest. It's they have a great habit of burying them on the outskirts and beyond the outskirts, thus allowing the trees to spread.
Like squirrels, jays famously gather up acorns and hazelnuts in autumn, carrying them off in their big, strong bill, hiding them away so they'll have a good stash to last the winter. We've heard about jays' impressive memory and cognitive clout. How they hide and recover thousands of acorns months after they've hidden them. Jays are not the only species who do this. Elsewhere, their clever crow cousins have evolved similar practices in different ecosystems.
The jays, of course, are a member of the crow family, but there are one or two other species in the same family that have exactly the same relationship. There's a bird in the Alps and in Siberia. It's the nutcracker. And it has the same relation to a type of pine that jays have to oak. And it's relied on up there to spread the seeds of the pine tree. And it was a great big bill designed to get in between the parts of the pine cone to extract the seed. So it's the same relationship. So you sense there a very old evolutionary story that part of the crow family specialized on spreading and having a symbiosis, essentially, with the big forest trees, like oaks or this pine species up in the Alps.
And the jays that are here, they depend on all of these acorns in the autumn for sustenance, but also to hide them away, to keep them going through the winter months.
Yeah, precisely.
And so the trees need the jays just as much as the jays need the trees.
This is a very clear symbiosis. I mean, ecosystems work by every species having a dependency of one sort or another on other species. And that when that dependency is gone, trouble breaks out. You can take it that most of nature is linked in to some other part of nature. It's, well, we could get very philosophical here and we could start talking about the change in European thought during the Age of Enlightenment and the way the individual becomes the centre of political philosophy in this, in Western Europe, America, and individualism takes off, so much so that we're marinated in it. So when we look at nature, we immediately analyze it in terms of individuals and even individual species. But we need to be careful. It certainly goes some distance in explaining nature to us, but another part of nature is the way all of these different elements are so closely interconnected. And intellectually, I think we find that hard to get our minds around. So this is just the philosophical background we're coming from, to see nature as a mass of competing individuals. Why? Well, we're predisposed to see human society as a mass of competing individuals. It's the sea we swim in, intellectually. And we never ask ourselves, well, maybe you're in the wrong pond. Maybe you should be thinking totally different. You're not competing against everything else. You're part of something bigger.
People have been wondering about jays forever, observing their behavior, hearing their scratchy calls, and coming up with all kinds of ideas about what it is they're doing or saying. With so little folklore about jays here in Ireland, I sought help from Professor David Hopkin from Oxford University, a specialist in Western European folklore and social history. I was delighted to discover that there's a wealth of folk tales related to jays in Occitan, Catalan, and French sources. Jays are seen as mischief makers. They're always up to no good. Their abilities to mimic other animals and sounds come up a lot in their folklore. There are all kinds of stories involving jays speaking when they screech, often thought to be hurling abuse at passers-by. There's even a story describing two jays negotiating a marriage proposal. An interesting take on the reality that jays do mate for life and are sometimes heard to be conversing with one another in a kind of call and response. One story that crops up in a few places is the story of how the jay got its feathers. My favourite of these is one from Catalonia, which I've adapted and added to a bit, as is the way with traditional folk tales. We asked a friend of ours who's intrigued by birds and folklore to narrate this story for us. Here is singer-songwriter and musician Lisa O'Neill.
The Cuckoo and the Jay. A long, long time ago, the jay was a stunningly handsome black bird who had a beautiful singing voice. She was clever as could be and always up to no good. She just couldn't help herself. One day, the jay was caught stealing another bird's acorns. A minor crime,
But the poor jay was stripped of her feathers as punishment and was brought before a judge and jury to stand trial. While the birds were deciding how to sentence the jay, the cuckoo arrived back from spending the winter in Africa. Back then, the cuckoo actually made her own nest and raised her own chicks in huge, very fancy nests. And the other small birds were very jealous of her. When the cuckoo saw her friend, the jay, naked on trial before the other birds, she was outraged and pleaded with the other birds to let the jay go free. But it wasn't enough for the other birds. The cuckoo knew how jealous they were of her beautiful home. But she didn't care about such shallow material things. She was a free bird. She could live however she wanted. The clever cuckoo had a cunning plan, and she gave a wink to the jay. She pledged she would never make a nest of her own again as long as the jay go free. She said that the jay would give up her beautiful song too. "We cuckoos are reliable," she said. "You can always trust a cuckoo." "There's one condition though," she said. "The jay can't go around naked like this. She won't be able to fly, and she'll get cold in the night. If we all give a feather or two, then she can fly free, and we'll keep our promises. Wait and see." All the birds agreed to the cuckoo's demands, and a few of them stood up to offer their feathers. And so, the jay flew off into the sky, the most colourful of all, with her mishmash of feathers. And she sang back every bird's song to them and let out a cackling, screeching laugh as she flew. And the cuckoo? Well, she kept her promise. She never made a nest of her own again.
Who's gonna give me a feather so blue? Blue like the sky that we fly in. Sea, where the silver fish jump in the morning, where the silver fish jump in the morning. A feather from my head, the kingfisher said,
is blau como el cel, but on volar.
Dressed of all,
plumage del cielo, la terra y el mar, rienda bayou with a body cuckoo, sparava am tots els colors i camp. They sang like the lark in the morning.
Jays might like to keep themselves hidden from our eyes, but we've gotten an incredible insight into their lives, their voices, their world, and how they think. There's a lot we now know, but also a lot to wonder about. One thing that really stands out is all the acorns and hazelnuts that jays hide but never collect, despite being so unbelievably clever. These are the seeds most likely to grow into the next generation of trees, having spent the winter neatly covered over with soil and leaves, perfectly placed to germinate the following spring and summer. Maybe the jays leave behind some tree seeds through forgetfulness, simple omission, or a surplus of supply.
But knowing how clever jays are, and how they're well capable of planning for the future, could it be possible that jays are aware of the consequences of their leaving enough acorns and hazelnuts hidden? That they understand symbiosis and are aware that their actions determine the future viability of the woodland that they are part of? Surely, caring for your habitat is as crucial as caring for the next generation, something we know that jays are very good at. Whether they're aware of it or not, jays are actively shaping the future of their home, in which their descendants will be able to survive and thrive. It has taken millions of years of evolution for this symbiotic relationship to perfect itself. Not only the oak, the hazel trees, and the jays are beneficiaries, but all the other trees and wild creatures who are nourished and sheltered in the woodland too. And all the other birds who depend on them, and all the ants and moths and butterflies and bees, all depend on this core relationship for their survival and continuity.
Jay, the second episode in that series, Feather and Flock, was presented by Anya Murray and Brian McLean. Aina Toulier played and sang a selection of Occitan traditional tunes and songs on nickel harpa and was accompanied on guitar and harmonium by Brian McLean for the song Dessous le Nostre Trillier. Harper, Leisha Kelly, was joined by Brian on fiddle and guitar, playing the closing tune, Winnie Hayes' Jig. The story, The Cuckoo and the Jay, was written and adapted from a Catalan folktale by Brian and told by Lisa O'Neill. Who's Going to Give Me a Feather was written by Rita Perry, Brian and Dermot McGlynn, and was sung by Rita and Brian with guitar and harmonium played by Brian. Understory was written and performed by Brian McLean on dulcimer and Gareth Quinn Redmond on electronics. The score, Feather and Flock, numbers 1 and 2, was written and performed by Brian on guitar and percussion. All the music in the programme was recorded, mixed and produced by Brian McLean, and all the soundscapes and bird sounds were recorded in the field by Brian and Sean Ronayne of Irish Wildlife Sounds. The series Feather and Flock is produced by Anya Murray, and the sound design is by Brian McLean.
This week's lyric feature was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland from the television licence fee. The producer for Lyric FM was Owen O'Kelly.
And if you know someone who might want to listen to that programme about jays or to last week's programme about the cuckoo, you can tell them that it's available to podcast from the lyric feature webpage, but it's also available from the RTE radio app and other podcast platforms. We'll be getting some information up on the RTE Culture website about the series at some stage next week, and we're also planning a playlist of some of the songs that Brian has written and performed for the series. You can contact the Lyric Feature with your suggestions or observations, features.lyricfm@rte.ie.